Brenda Rainey, our Director of Government Relations. We are delighted that in these very challenging economic times, the original appropriation of the Science Museum from the state's budget has been reduced only by 5%. And with the money that you allow us to retain, we hope we're going to make you very proud. Now, before we start meetings at the Science Museum, whether it's our board meetings or our staff meetings, we usually go through what we call a science moment, and it just seemed to me like the best way for me to be comfortable in front of this august body. Watch carefully my fingers. Never leave my hand.
Fingers never.
This is a demonstration that we have of hysteresis. Hysteresis is the internal friction of material. These two balls have the same level of density. They squeeze and feel the same, yet one rerounds faster than the other at a rate that the eye can't perceive. That ball gets round a bit slower than this one. Nazarene and neoprene, two different rubbers, which are often brought together to make tires because they also have a different coefficient of friction. That is to say, if you roll them or give them to your children to roll, one will roll faster and further than the other. You want friction so that you can stop. You want a lower coefficient of friction so that you get better gas mileage. This is the challenge in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And the bigger challenge, if you put both of these in the freezer, they will reverse their properties completely. The one which doesn't bounce will bounce, and the other one will not. So enjoy them. Have some fun.
Okay, we'll be glad. One, two, three.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's really fun.
Well, enjoy them. We do.
Fascinating.
We think that we do something wonderful with science, and that is we get people young and old turned on to science. And at the Science Museum, this is important because we believe science to be an essential literacy. It's the literacy of the future. According to the U.S. Department of Commerce, 3 out of 5 new jobs that are going to be created in the next decade that pay more than minimum wage are going to be in the sciences. They're going to require a background in science, technology, engineering, or math. It's a sector of our economy which even now has grown 3 times faster than the rest of the economy in the United States. If our young people are going to have a chance for economic participation in the future, we know we need to get them engaged in science, technology, engineering, and math. But if our state is to hold its place in preeminence as a center of nanotechnology and nanobiology, as a place that looks at genetically modified organisms, developing alternative sources of energy, we need a citizenry which is also informed about science. Science is essential for civic engagement. And we need to be concerned. We need to be concerned that today, according to the National Science Foundation, 48% of U.S. high school graduates surveyed cannot accurately identify that it takes the Earth 1 year to revolve around the sun. We need to have sound civic discourse on issues of science with an informed body of politic. And the Science Museum is about just that. We convene groups from all over the state to discuss the management of our natural resources, to understand the implications of science and science policy statewide, nationwide, and internationally. We bring in students, we bring in teachers, we bring in families. We're doing our best to be relevant to the needs of this state. Last year, the Science Museum of Minnesota provided more teacher professional development in math and science than any other source. We do more teacher training than the U, and we do it in ways that are incredibly creative. Last year, we met 1 in 4 students in their classrooms, and while we did whole school assemblies, we took the teachers aside and gave them additional teacher training and support. In the last 2 years, we've built a science resource center which has become a national model, an international model, so much so that the European Union has invited me to Brussels to speak to its parliament about what's happening in Minnesota. We're changing the way math happens around this nation as well. A few years ago, we used to get students excited about dinosaurs. They'd come through our museum, they'd be absolutely thrilled with dinosaurs, and we'd send them back to a school, and there were no dinosaurs. That's an unfair thing to do to teachers. Today, when kids get off the bus, they pick up a math backpack. It's got rulers, calipers, a pith helmet. It's got everything they need to be a scientist, including a scientific journal and log. And they'd run around the museum measuring the thigh bone of a dinosaur, measuring the thigh bone of their teacher. We trained 1,200 teachers in how to use those students' data that they were deeply involved with and excited with to do standards-based mathematics in 5th, 6th, and 7th grade. And the students who have been in the programs that these teachers were trained in have higher rates of homework completion, lower rates of absenteeism. It's a part of why we're achieving more in math and science in this state than we ever have in the past. That program made the cover of Teaching Children Mathematics. It's now been emulated by 47 museums in 27 states, and it's Minnesota grown. We think we're essential to education and to lighting the spark that gets kids interested, to giving teachers the resources they need. Our Teacher Resource Center has been so successful that MinSCU is now looking to model 3 of these on their own campuses. We think we made a good investment. We also, in addition to training teachers, are holders of great resources for the state. Nearly 100 years ago, a dentist in Minnesota started trekking all across our state collecting seeds of the most valuable parts of our environment. The resources and the genetic biological record that exist, we propagate every 10 years to keep that record fresh. We maintain the history of our state's biodiversity. We monitor the history of our water quality through our programs at the St. Croix Research Station. We build great exhibits and films. We put together Seasons, the only movie, IMAX movie, ever made exclusively in and about Minnesota and its wonderful environment. We manage the largest collection of gifted American Indian artifacts in the state, and artifacts from every culture that has moved in and through our state. We hold on to our state's resources, and we help people learn about stewardship. We hope we also start great conversations. Last year, we put together a program on race that was meant to promote civic discourse, and it did it in a way beyond any of our expectations. And we wanted it to leave a footprint. More than experiencing an exhibit, we wanted to put capacity in our region. And so we put out a call to 100 United Way agencies and said, if you have someone we can train, we'll help them learn how to promote civic discourse and give them a chance to run a talking circle on issues of race. Well, we were troubled when we got 120 responses that we might not be able to train them, but we did. And then we were troubled with 120 people trained from 100 agencies that would have a talking circle for each of them. Well, our talking circle sold out. Everyone that we could staff was staffed. The entire public safety departments of our police and our fire in the Twin Cities went through the exhibit. That exhibit is now touring America. It was originally scheduled to tour for 3 years. We had to extend it to 5 years, and then 5.5, because they're going to hold a joint session of Congress in Washington, D.C., in this exhibit. And we are going to duplicate the exhibit again because we have 31 additional museums on our waiting list. Nearly 100 communities are going to benefit from what we started here in Minnesota. And here's how we started it. We started it with the foundation of a good building that allows us to do great things. And that $1.25 million that we had received from the state was essential to our basic operating services. I have donors who will support our tickets for low-income programming, 35,000 families who could come through the museum as members with the same ticket you and I would buy, but for only a dollar. Every film, every exhibit we have. I'm afraid we're going to have many more people who want that next year. We'll do our best to keep it going, but I can get a donor to help with that. I have not yet found a donor who will pay for a plaque that says, I waxed the floors and vacuumed the carpet of the science museum. That's what your dollars do. It gives us a building that allows us to do great things. It gives us a building that allows us to bid competitively for National Science Foundation grants. Last year, we achieved a great milestone. The Science Museum of Minnesota receives more funding from the National Science Foundation, peer-reviewed competitive funding, than any other museum in America. We receive more funding from the National Science Foundation than the combined totals of the Smithsonian. We bring in over $6 million in our state economy, but we couldn't do it without that $1.25 million that allows us to say we have the facility to launch a great idea. We couldn't bring in nearly 1 million visitors without that $1.25 million that says we have the facility to give you a great experience. It's essential money. We've got a fairly large budget, and this looks like just 3% of our budget, but it's nearly 20% of the money that we have to put to our basic operating services. And at $80,000 a month in utility bills, I can't take much more strain out of any other basic operating service budget. And so it's been a critical part of who we are and how we move forward. And it's a part of what will be the future of this state. I should tell you about that one exhibit on race. When the American Association of Museums reviewed all exhibits in public art museums, in history museums, in science museums, in natural science museums, and in specialized museums, last year they chose one exhibit as exhibit of the year, and it was our exhibit on race. We beat out Picasso. And we did it here in Minnesota. And we did it for our community, and we engendered conversations that have been repeating themselves again and again. Last, as a follow-up to the race exhibit, we partnered with the National Holocaust Memorial Museum and started a conversation on genocide. We've done more important work, and we will do more. We've brought in great exhibits that excite everyone. We've learned we need to turn teenagers onto science and not turn them out the door. But teenagers do not aspire to go where their younger siblings go. They want to go where the 20-somethings go. And so we've increased our teenage population significantly by being relevant to the 20-somethings. Exhibits like Body Worlds, Pompeii, the Italian government only allowed 4 cities in all of North America to exhibit the treasures of Pompeii. The Science Museum was among them. And next year, well, I've just returned from Israel. In Israel, they're very careful about what fragments, if any, of their antiquities they allow out. And they've allowed postage stamp pieces of the Dead Sea Scrolls to be exhibited. But we managed to strike a deal based on our reputation as one of the most forward-looking museums in the nation. Next year, we are bringing out the largest, most complete version of the Book of Genesis from the Dead Sea Scrolls that has ever been exhibited. It has not even been seen in Israel. And we are pairing it with artifacts from the Israeli Antiquity Authority from the Second Temple period that will be bringing out incredible things, changemakers' tables from the time of Jesus' ministry. And we're doing the science of this. We are looking at the genetics of the skin that the scrolls are written on to answer questions. Are they from one tribe or multiple tribes? We'll be showing the story of restoration and of stewardship. We're going to show how responsibility over a 2,000-year period gave us the foundation for who we are today. We're going to be relevant to this state, and we will continue to do it if you can help us wash the windows, vacuum the floors, and have a basic infrastructure that lets me bring the money and resources into this state that employs 350 people full-time and another 300 part-time employees, that engages 1,200 volunteers from every age spectrum and gives them a chance to contribute to the meaning of what it is to be a proud Minnesotan institution. Madam Chair, members, thank you for your attention. I will be delighted to answer any questions that you might have.
Great. Dr. Jolly, thank you very much. I mean, I can see how you like to inspire people about science, and you did that already today in a short time. And so I really appreciate this presentation. It's, you know, a lot of us go to the Science Museum. We take our families there. But to hear all those stories about things we might not know about what you're doing and your stature around the country and the world is really remarkable. And we need to be really proud of that. And so, and I want to ask for the latecomers, should we let the early folks, should we let them have the demonstration again?
Yes.
All right. We'll let you see what the little toys are. If you don't mind, Dr. Jolly, one more time.
I don't. Watch very carefully. As I have pointed out, my fingers never leave my hand. These two balls have the same density, but they have very different properties. And those properties explain what we call hysteresis, the internal friction by which they reround themselves and make themselves right. And as a part of the science that we talked about in Minnesota, we're making good snow tires. If you put these in a freezer, the properties of each ball will reverse. But it's also the story of hysteresis in rerounding. And what I didn't say last time, so that we add one more factoid to this, is as the glacial caps are melting, great weight is coming off of the Earth, and it has a hysteresis coefficient as well. The Earth is actually rerounding as we speak by nearly 1.25 inches a year, becoming a more perfect sphere. All of that can be demonstrated here, and we are happy to do that.
Does that mean that the Earth would bounce?
No, the Earth would actually look more like that.
Oh, okay. It wouldn't bounce. Yeah.
It would absorb the energy internally.
Okay.
I'll be happy to entertain any questions, Madam Chair.
Well, and Dr. Jolly, I appreciate you started out by acknowledging the governor's recommendation as a 5% cut and that you see that as, you've gone through some significant cuts over the last couple of bienniums, and so that you recognize that that's something you could probably live with given the choices this session. What will be the impact of this cut specifically?
Madam Chair, members, the cut that we're looking at is going to have to be absorbed from our general staffing in all likelihood. It would be my hope that we will find a position that we will not fill and double up on someone's work. But the cut will mean that we will not be able to expand our ticketing opportunities for the very poorest of our citizens. It's a small cut, but an important cut to our core operating budget. And we are working out that as we speak. I just came from a meeting of my senior staff to see how can we manage this cut. How will we manage this cut if it's paired with other economic downturns, like a loss of citizens spending money in the museum? And we're preparing a recession plan for that. At this time, I can't give you specifics as to where we will cut, other than it will have to come out of something core. As you know, the Science Museum went from having significant funding from our county, over $1 million, to zero in the last 5 years, having a state budget of nearly $1.3 million to at one point as low as $750,000. We cut to absorb all of those reductions, and we have not added any fat back onto our bones. So I am concerned. However, I would rather have my job, with all due respect, than yours, as my budget will be easier to balance even with a 5% cut.
Is he your constituent?
Have you seen any changes in attendance in the past few months? Has it been pretty steady?
Madam Chair, our attendance has been steady. It's actually slightly up. And the things that we track is we're looking at other cultural institutions around the country. Science museums have been closing. They're looking at an average of 17% reduction in attendance. I think it's a tribute to the citizens of our state, their joy for education, the reason why we have more MPR members per capita than anywhere else, that they love education. And so our attendance is actually up above our predictions. Our average ticket price, the amount of money which people spend when they visit the museum, is down significantly, nearly 20%. But our increase in attendance is offsetting it. We hope this will continue. We believe that when Minnesotans are faced with the choices of taking a vacation across the border or one in town, they're choosing more often to be in town. And so our attendance is steady, somewhat elevated from our expectations. Our income from visitors is down slightly, but we're still earning about 63% of our own income, which puts us in the top 5 most independent museums in the nation with a budget above $1 million.
Okay. Are there other questions? Senator Rummel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Jolly, all I can say is, as a Minnesotan, what you've brought to this state is just extraordinary. And in particular, I appreciated your telling us how far that exhibit on race has gone, and it makes me feel very proud that we have an institution that can think about the big and pressing questions of our time and translate it into a way that is accessible to all of us, and that's a gift that I think There's no dollars to match, so appreciate all that you do for us.
Madam Chair, Senator, thank you very much. When I was asked why I wanted to come to Minnesota, I long ago said because it's the place where change can happen. And Minnesotans have given this institution the leverage to not only change their own life but be a beacon to the world. I hope we will continue to honor that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Rummel. In budget times like this, it is kind of tempting to talk about how we can only afford the very essential things. And so, you know, it'd be easy for people to say that museums aren't essential. but I think they are essential. And they're essential to what makes Minnesota the place it is. And we wouldn't be the same state without the presence of the Science Museum. So thank you for your good work. Did you say that Congress is going to be meeting in this exhibit? Where will that
take
place?
It's my understanding the Smithsonian has contracted to rent the exhibit on race, and they have done it with an invitation going to the legislature, and there are plans now for a joint session of Congress. It's almost 5 years off because our exhibit is booked that far in advance.
Wow. Okay, that's great. That's impressive. Well, we'll stay tuned for hearing about that. All right, if there's any questions about the budget, are we about
hysteresis?
Hysteresis, okay. And I can't wait to go home and put these in the freezer.
Yeah. Thank you.
Great, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you, members.
All right. We'll turn to the Bowser budget, and John Jaski is here, the executive director. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. The page will be handing out a copy of my presentation as well as a couple of accessory materials that go with that.
But did you bring anything that we could play with?
Madam Chair, I did not. All of the things that we do are out on the land, and bringing in a wetland or a lake or a stream or a conservation practice wasn't going to happen today.
Doesn't have a tab. I think, Bowser, the budget pages are right at the very beginning of your notebooks. So we'll get a tab. It's
notebook?
Not marked for some reason, but we'll get that. Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, members, I'm going to go through an overview of our agency and the activities and responsibilities, and then I will get to the budget components near the end of my presentation and answer any questions you might have along the way. You can see there on the first page, our agency's mission is to improve and protect Minnesota's soil and water resources by working in partnership with local organizations and the focus on private landowners. And you can see that the map there shows the areas of the state where we have our private lands emphasis, which is in the southern and western parts of the state. And if you could blow up this map a little bit more largely, you would have a chance to see where our impaired waters are in relationship to our land ownership. And clearly most of them are in areas where we have private land ownership. Just to tie to the Science Museum, our local governments are the ones that bring that science, that applied science, together with the citizens and get projects accomplished to improve the land and water resources of the state of Minnesota. On the next page, you can see that 78% of the state's land is in private ownership, so that's an important connection to our clean water activities going forward. Our local governments are the ones that have principal authority over land use and the most direct contact with our citizens. They're the most influential in planning how our land's going to be used into the future. And certainly our land and water have a very close connection. On the bottom of page 2, you can see our agency organization. We have a board, a 17-member board that includes local governments, 3 county commissioners, 3 soil and water conservation district supervisors, and 3 watershed district managers. We also have 3 citizens, and we have 5 agency representatives: University of Minnesota, Department of Natural Resources, Pollution Control Agency, Department of Agriculture, and Department of Health. We have monthly meetings with committee meetings that happen in between those meetings generally. We have 75 staff approximately in 8 different offices around the state, and you can see that those staff are responsible for overseeing and assisting those local government organizations there that are listed across the state. On top of page 3, I won't go into all the details. These are some of the statutory responsibilities and the citations for those, and we'll cover some of those in more detail, just more of a reference for you. First of all, the soil and water conservation districts. We have soil and water conservation districts across the entire state. They were established in federal legislation actually back in 1935, and their purpose has been, as it has since the beginning, although it's evolved in some cases quite a bit, to preserve our soil and water and the connections between the two, often in a partnership with our state agencies and our federal government, as well as the local resources that they bring to that mix. It's basically, it started out as about a one-third proportion, and I think the state share has fallen down to about a quarter now, but that's the way they fund their operations because they are dependent on the state, federal, and local funding from other sources. They do not generate their own revenue through a levy of any sort. On the next page, in the top of page 4, the watershed districts, and you can see that their authorities have been in place since 1955, and they are established as special purpose districts in most every case to cross a geopolitical boundary to manage water. The watershed districts are appointed by the county commissioners to manage that set of responsibilities. Many of them are also the drainage authority managing our public ditch systems. They also have the authority to levy for and establish projects, as well as put in place standards to protect existing water resources. Bottom of page 4, we have every county in the state has developed and adopted a local water management plan, and that map on the left shows those that are currently in a state of development. On the right-hand side, we have a set of standards in place in the metropolitan area only, in the 7-county metropolitan area, but we have watershed management that is done by the watershed districts or joint powers organizations of cities. You see here the cover of this plan from Stearns County, and it's just one example of many, but the most important parts of these plans are not the cover, but the actual components at the very end of these plans, which implement the projects and the priorities that those citizens and the science that they've looked at direct them to do. And so each one of these plans, either they're typically 10 years, some are 5 years, they lay out a schedule for implementation and cost to achieve those water quality and other water management goals. Top of page 5, all of them really are trying to figure out the best way to manage watersheds, which have a variety of land uses and often cross geopolitical boundaries. In the bottom of the page, these plans of action take many different scales. You can see that many of you are familiar with the hypoxia issue in the Gulf of Mexico, where we have an area that is biologically inert, in essence, because of the water quality coming down to the Mississippi River to the Gulf. But we also have, on a much more practical scale, plans like you see on the left for a portion of one watershed to manage those issues locally. And that's the ones that our local governments are focused on, and the responsibility to connect those plans to the citizens' needs and the science that they use to derive those plans. On the top of page 6, regardless of scale, these are basically the tools that we have in place to improve our watersheds. And you can note that the first of those, the data collection, analysis, and planning, we call that step 0 because it actually doesn't get anything done on the ground or change the landscape for the better, but it sets the stage for which things are most important to do, which are most cost-effective to do, and which ones to do first. And then you can see the three tools there are typically a package of these in each of these plans, some amount of education to change behaviors and practices, funding to build projects to restore land or to protect citizens in some cases from natural resource disasters such as flooding, and also a component of regulation which allows them to preserve what we have for the current circumstances and going forward improving it. And then, of course, this cycle happens all over again when they every 10 years update those plans. On the bottom of page 6, the scale, again, I'll mention here with Minnesota being an example. This is the Red River Basin, including Minnesota, North Dakota, and the provinces of Canada. And you can see that the Red River starts in the boundary between Minnesota and South Dakota, actually, and flows northward. And that flows through Lake Winnipeg, which is a major resource, of course, connected to the city of Winnipeg and beyond. And there's a plan, a basin approach, that's been established here, an international organization that Minnesota is a partner and a member in, along with the other states and provinces. A little bit smaller scale, but in the same area, on the top of page 7, in Minnesota, we have a group of watershed districts organized up in the Red River Valley. They were organized originally around the issue of flooding on the main stem of the Red River, as well as many of the tributaries. And you can see the importance of coordinating their activities as a basin, because as they do projects and as they implement their activities and their plans, it's important to know how they're going to store floodwater in each of their respective areas so that they time it enough that they have a response on the main stem that is not going to be any worse than it is now and hopefully quite a bit better. And they are doing many of these projects in coordination via a basin approach across all of those watershed districts and counties. Getting a little bit smaller yet, down at the bottom of page 7, here's a watershed district or a watershed organization that's in the metropolitan area that encompasses two counties, where they're managing a very diverse watershed that has agriculture, suburban development, and a high recreational value, and doing it again through a watershed plan that bridges those two county boundaries and those two counties' authorities. On the top of page 8, we get much more burrowing down here into ever more detailed specificity. This is an example of a component of the Soil and Water Conservation District plan in Stearns County, but they've done the assessment of the highest priority areas for them to focus their efforts and the efforts of others that can bring funding to their operation. You can't see all the details here, but this lets you know that they've made an effort to assess the landscape, look at the science, and figure out where they want to go first with the most effective use of their funding. And then ultimately it gets right down to a piece of land that is going to have some changes made to it to improve the water quality and the soil conservation efforts on that landscape. And you can see here's an example of a variety of conservation practices that are being contemplated for this particular piece of land. On the top of page 9, then, I'll get into a few details about some of the programmatic responsibilities. The Wetland Conservation Act is a state's law to protect wetlands. No net loss is the goal. Increasing the quantity, quality, and biological diversity is also a goal. And there's an entire set of statutes and rules that are in place to accomplish this. We oversee that program. Local governments carry out the day-to-day activities. And you can see there on the bottom of the page a variety of responsibilities and roles that we play in making that program work. On the top of page 10, just a little process for those of you interested in the enforcement aspects of the law. We have to have due process, and there's a couple of different options, both criminal and civil, to accomplish compliance when needed. Our field staff also spend a good bit of time evaluating where the wetland edge is. It's known as wetland delineation. You can see that picture in the bottom of page 10. You got the same site in quite different circumstances, and our methodologies that our staff are trained in allow them to determine the regulatory edge of that wetland regardless of the conditions that they may be experiencing at the given moment. We also have developed tools to assess the wetland function. And that's important because in certain cases, wetlands are going to be drained or filled and then replaced through what's known as wetland mitigation, which is part of the law as well, and that's on page 11. On the top of page 11 shows a couple of examples of, in the small photos there, of areas where wetlands are being impacted because of some project. Roads are often a kind of project where you can't avoid impacting a wetland, especially in some parts of the state where we have many, many wetlands. We've developed a wetland banking system, which allows for that mitigation to be done both coordinated in a cost-effective manner, where persons who are interested in restoring a wetland can sell the credits they established for that project to those who are in need of offsetting their impacts to a wetland someplace else. This system is in place to not only accomplish that between private parties, but also the state has a responsibility to replace these wetlands that are lost due to local road authority projects, and we accomplish that on behalf of them. We also have coordinated with MnDOT to do that comprehensively for the state as a whole to be more efficient with our resources and our planning efforts. On top of page 12, there's some recent highlights of activities underway right now. I mentioned a couple already. We've got a major rule revision that's about halfway through the process, maybe a little further than that, based on legislation that was enacted in 2007. That rule is now up for public review and comment. As I mentioned, we've got this agreement with the Department of Transportation to opt to mitigate wetlands on their behalf so that we make the best use of our state dollars. We have two agreements that are in the works, one with the Army Corps of Engineers to align the state's protection with the Clean Water Act at the federal level. And we also are working on one that we've just begun with the U.S. Department of Agriculture because they have a provision in the Farm Bill known as Swamp Buster that also requires wetland issues to be addressed. And finally, we've spent some time in the last year and a half or so conducting and completing an inventory of wetland mitigation opportunities in northeastern Minnesota based on some legislation that was passed and funded in 2007. And that project is important because in northeastern Minnesota, the opportunities to find a wetland to replace one that you impact are low, and the odds of hitting a wetland when you do a project are very, very high. Okay, so we're trying to address those unique circumstances that they have in northeastern and north central Minnesota. They're often referred to as the greater than 80% counties because they have more than 80% of their original wetlands still remaining. Another program that we spend a good bit of time on is our conservation cost share program, where we deal with soil and water conservation issues that are targeted at sediment problems and some of the chemistry that goes with that movement of sediment off the land into the water. You can see on page 13 there's some pictures, you know, of different problems that this program is targeted at. In the upper left, there's an area that's eroding in an agricultural setting, and that probably could use a waterway that was designed to manage that water flowing off that field. In the lower left, you see an area that where the channel, the water, flood water came out of the channel, went over the field, and then ultimately back in, and that's an area where you might be looking at some riparian buffer or an easement program to set that land aside for soil protection as well as flood relief. In the upper right, hard to tell what that is. It's a little bit small, but that's an area of a wetland restoration that where the activity is to manage the vegetation as well as the restoration site. There's a reed canary infestation issue there, and they have to go out and manage that before they actually get the wetland restored. And in the lower right, there's a feedlot that has gotten very connected to the waterway here, and so some of the options there are to do some fencing and also to put in perhaps a roof feeding area or a more confined area for the feedlot operation to keep the animals and their activities out of the water. Thanks. And in the center there you see a lakeshore site where we've got some, you know, land that is not any longer protected by vegetation, if it ever was, and we need to do something there to stabilize that shoreline from wave erosion and other things. And down on the bottom, you see some examples of the solutions to those problems, riparian buffers, great stabilization projects where you get some sediment and erosion control as well as flood control. Conservation tillage has been a really expanded activity over the last couple of maybe 10, 12 years. Many more landowners and farmers are going to that approach because it both saves them funds for fuel as well as preserving the soil and keeping it productive long term. The contour cropping, you can pretty much understand what that is. It allows the land to be utilized but minimizes the sedimentation coming off the land. And we also then see a bioretention project there in the center, which is on the lakeshore where we're trying to reestablish the soil stability along that lake bank. On page 14, I got the same picture twice, it looks like, but we want to get into drainage management. We also want to show you that rain garden there in the lower right-hand corner. We also, in the urban areas, are doing a lot more projects that involve taking water that is on or is rooted onto impervious surfaces and moving it back into pervious surfaces to get more infiltration, which helps to both clean the water as well as store the water before it moves downstream. Drainage management, we've got a drainage work group team that's been established in the last 3 or 4 years, and they both provide policy recommendations as well as project recommendations for managing those systems that are been built over the last number of, I guess, the last century to manage the landscapes where we need to get the water off the land for productivity purposes. On the top of page 15, you can see a map that shows the altered water courses in the state, which we otherwise refer to as ditches. They are also supplemented by a good bit of subsurface drainage systems that are connected to these systems, and ultimately move into our water courses that are, some of which are impaired. And dealing with these systems is going to be a challenge going forward, but the drainage authorities have shown a willingness to help contribute to the water quality needs that they understand are going to affect downstream landowners. The bottom there shows a good example and a not-so-good example of a ditch buffer that in some cases is required along our altered water courses. The law does not require it in every case, but we've been working with landowners and local governments to encourage that to be put in place under any set of circumstances, and we have a number of programs that have some ability to cost share on that effort. On top of page 16, there are some innovative things going on in the drainage area as well. Here's a ditch system where they've got a two-stage channel so that the low flows can be accommodated in this restored sinuous channel, whereas the large flooding events would be able to be conveyed through the volume that can go above that channel through more of a traditional straight-line ditch system. This helps get water quality benefits as well as flood control when you can provide some sinuosity back into that system as well as a permanent vegetative cover along that buffer area. The bottom of page 16, we have a state soils office. We're the state soils agency, and we work in coordination with the U.S. Department of Agriculture as well as University of Minnesota to make sure that our soils are healthy and productive and stay where they need to be on the land. Many of the soil and water districts offer soil testing, and we also, you can see there, coordinate some research that those three test tubes in the top there show the harm that can be caused by soil compaction, both in urban and rural settings, through machinery and development. When our soil is compacted, it loses its productivity, and getting that back into the land is important. There's experimentation going on right now to try and restore the soils to get back some of that soil tilth to make it more productive. Top of page 17, Clean Water Legacy, legislation that was passed a couple of years ago, and many of you know all about this. But it's all about the quality of life of the citizens of the state experience, and here's an example of a site in Dakota County where I used to work, Lake Bilsby, and there was a significant regional park there at that lake, but of course the watershed for that lake, which is a reservoir, and in fact, comes from many, many miles and many counties away, and so we have to manage this system if we're going to improve it based on that entire watershed, which involves, in this case, six different counties. Just a couple of examples of the kinds of things that we need to address: nutrient loading and sedimentation. Often the two are related, but not always. In some cases, we have wastewater plants that are providing contributions for nutrients, and we have, of course, sedimentation coming from either in-channel erosion or off-the-land erosion. The top of page 18, the Clean Water Legacy was begun with one-time funding that occurred in the past biennium, and I'll get to that later on in the presentation. And there's a number of projects that are underway that are dealing with this all over the state. And there's a couple up here, one from southeastern Minnesota, one from northeast. We also have a number of projects in the metropolitan or urban areas of the state. And the main theme is that we're trying to get the water to stay on the site rather than getting it off the site. This example here in the bottom of page 18, you know, you can see in the upper left we've got a construction area that has got exposed soil, and we've got, you know, regulations in place to deal with that, many implemented by local governments. But we also are going to need to design our systems so that we keep the water on site rather than making it leave the site as soon as possible. And on the top of page 19, there's an example at that same rain garden area in Burnsville, which were various organizations that participated in, but many more of these now are getting some portion of public funding to get them started, and the citizens generally take them on with some coordinated assistance design-wise and keep them up. You get more infiltration and less runoff. You have fewer pipes and hard infrastructure to deal with. Maintenance is a concern, but it's a concern under any set of circumstances, and if the landowners are willing to keep them up, they function very, very well for a very long time. On to another program, our conservation easements are Reinvest in Minnesota. Wetland restorations are something that we've done a lot of in the past number of decades. Here's one at the top that has both, you know, multiple benefits of flood control, water quality, and habitat, as well as an important upland buffer that's got native grasses growing on around that wetland. The one on the bottom is actually done as part of a public ditch project where we are building in some water quality and floodwater storage, as well as habitat, of course, in conjunction with one of these public ditch systems. And that's a new thing that adjustments to the drainage law allowed for a couple of years ago. On the top of page 20, here's one that isn't done yet, but is in the planning stage. In Carver County, it's a large former wetland that's been drained and ditched and pumped, actually, some of the water right into Lake Waconia. And this wetland will be restored this summer, and in partnership with both funding from the state as well as from the federal government. The right little diagram there, that graph, just is an example of a study that was done out in the west central Minnesota, looking at the benefits, the water quality benefits of land retirement and wetland restorations. And there's more to it than this, obviously, but the main message is that if we can put in riparian buffers, especially those ones that are the nearest to the stream, that first 50 feet or so is really critical, that we can dramatically improve the water quality in the stream. And these numbers are measuring what's known as the Index of Biological Integrity, or IBI, which is an assessment of the macro invertebrates in the stream, which is a really good representation of the water quality that is improving in this case in these different channels. We also, in Reinvest Minnesota, have been able to secure federal funding to restore and preserve land around the Camp Ripley in central Minnesota, major National Guard base that is needing to preserve their use of that property for military training, but they also have been paying for conservation efforts around that perimeter in order to keep that from being developed long-term and be able to continue the use that they have for that site. We've also spent some time, if you can turn the page to page 21, spending some time looking at the design and monitoring of all of these easements that we've done wetland restorations on, tracking the progress of both the plant communities as well as the habitat and the water quality, trying to be more systematic about making sure the investment we've made in these sites is still what we think it is. On to page 22, one of the things that we've done with some legislation that was authorized last year is put in place the option to do seed harvesting and bioenergy harvesting on these easement sites. If landowners are interested in that, you know, we can adjust the management plan to allow for those activities to occur that do not in any way negatively affect the water quality or the wildlife habitat functions. And typically these activities would occur sometime later in the summer, usually into the August time frame. So those are some adjustments that are being made to the program currently. There was recently a wetland restoration strategy put together through a group of agencies and interest groups to try and help us decide where we should be looking to spend our limited resources on wetland restoration first. Lots of data out there, but you look at the map on the left. This shows the expiring CRP lands, which is one factor to consider, because those lands, which are in a temporary conservation program paid for by USDA, will be no longer in conservation unless they re-enroll or if we find a way to get them permanently enrolled into a long-term conservation program like RIM. On the bottom right, these are some of the tools we have for prioritizing where those sites should be located. This is a habitat map based on Fish and Wildlife Service analysis. On the top of page 23, we've got some much more localized targeting tools that we've been utilizing and putting in the hands of our local governments. The one on the upper left is, you know, basically the riparian areas along this particular stream that are in cultivation or in red, and those that are in some sort of permanent cover in green. And so we have this kind of information that local governments can use to pick their most important locations to spend their dollars. The map on the right allows us to pick among all the restorable wetlands on the landscape those that are most beneficial for water quality or habitat. And in the bottom there, you see there's multiple benefits from these projects. We talked about the water quality, the flood control, the habitat, and as well as the carbon sequestration and other functions. The top of page 24 is another project that you can just kind of get some idea that we're doing a a bit of an initiative that's a pilot in nature on up in the Red River Valley, where we've secured a conservation easement over a corridor along a stream that was formerly, you know, straightened and re-established that stream meander, put native grasses along that corridor, and then in this case there's also a wetland restoration that is included at the very top of this project that has flood control benefits because they can adjust the outlet to remove the water before the floods come, and they can also get a great deal of habitat benefits out of it as well because they leave it with sufficient water in it during those critical times during the nesting and migration seasons. On the bottom of page 24, we through legislative appropriations, spent quite a bit of time in the last year and a half helping with the recovery down in the southeastern part of the state, those seven counties that had that major flooding event in August of 2007. Those state funds leveraged a great amount of federal funding from USDA and from the Army Corps of Engineers and others. So we wanted to just highlight that as something that is going to be winding down in the next year and a half, but it's still a very important help to those communities down in the southeastern part of Minnesota. And there's lots of these smaller scale ones on the top of page 25 where all throughout this landscape there were damages of these various structures and conservation efforts. And just in a small, much smaller scale, you know, the small 400-acre drainage area where the structure there that was providing some water quality and flood control benefits was damaged and had to be repaired. And there were many, many of these, and they're still out assessing all of the needs and setting priorities, and we'll be putting those projects on the ground again this summer. On the bottom of page 25, we have a responsibility in legislation that began in this committee 2 years ago to provide accountability and oversight of our local water management authorities. We have a legislative report that has been mandated, and this will be the second year that we'll be providing that to the various committees that have jurisdiction over this issue. We've got a set of principles here, and we've been implementing this with limited funding, mind you, over the last year and a half. And we'll be happy to give you an update on that at some point down the road. On page 26, we also have in place mechanisms to track the results of the project dollars that get funded. On the left, that small map just shows the different kinds of projects, the filter strips, grade stabilizations, et cetera. And then on the right there, we are able to, through this system that known as E-Link, estimate the amount of pollutant reduction benefits that each of those projects or each of them or them collectively over any particular part of the state provide. This also can be used and is used to track many different parameters, but this is just one example of that. And then getting up closer to the current time frame, on the bottom of page 26, we sponsored a series of listening sessions to go out in the month of December around the state to seven locations and listen to what the local governments and agency folks and the citizens to some extent were thinking about as to how we would best utilize this new funding for clean water and outdoor heritage. And in your materials, there's a complete version of this summary of what we heard at those sessions around the state. And we've been able to provide this to different groups that are also involved in making recommendations on how to make the most of that funding. On the top of page 27, some trends and challenges that we see coming up. Certainly we're excited about the expanded use of technology. It's been an efficiency that we strongly support and utilize. You got to invest up front, but in almost every case pays dividends down the road with efficiencies as well as better information and a better way to track the outcomes that we're all expected to provide. We also are seeing much more collaboration. You know, I think the watershed approach to how we do business has really been a push in the right direction to accomplish that. On the downside, the demographics, you know, there's fewer people that are connected to the land, it seems like, and especially in our rural communities, and that's a challenge going forward. On the upside, though, we do see more and more interest by citizens and landowners to be willing to participate and want to participate and want to understand how their role and how their interests can help the state's interests collectively in our clean water efforts. a bit of a question mark about soil productivity and sustainability. You know, we are asking the soils in this state to do an awful lot. Some of you may have seen a National Geographic piece on, I think it was September of last year. Minnesota has some of the best soils in the world. And, you know, we've been utilizing them for productivity gains for decades, and that's a good thing. But we also are going to be expecting them to provide more and more of our energy, perhaps, going forward. And we're going to have to make sure we have soils that are productive but also sustainable, because the soil takes 500 years to form an inch of topsoil. And we're making some. That's good, but it comes real slow. So we've got to make sure we make the most of what we have. We also are seeing an emphasis on multiple benefits projects. We heard that over and over when we went out and listened to those folks around the state in December. They said, you know, make sure you do projects that have multiple benefits for water quality and habitat and carbon sequestration and flood control and those sorts of things. We've also been able to, in the last few years and even before that, leverage a good bit of federal funding to complement and supplement our state resources that we have committed to conservation of clean water. Okay, on to the numbers. I'll give a quick review of the previous biennium, and I'm sure you may have some questions. Just a breakdown on the bottom of page 27, the breakdown between the agency operations and the grants that we provide to local water management authorities is about 24% to 76%, and that's a pretty consistent ratio. It doesn't include any of the bonding funds that we may have being used for wetland restorations and so forth. On the top of page 28, more detailed breakdown of our operational budget. You see that, like most organizations, the salaries and benefits are the biggest part of that, along with technology and communication, et cetera, and travel. The grants, the other portion of our budget there in the bottom of page 28, variety of things, some of which were one-time funding in the previous biennium, but you can see here these are all the different programs that I've described previously, at least I hope I have. If you have any questions, I can certainly answer that. The chart on top of page 29 then takes us up to the current moment, kind of a general breakdown of the different revenue sources that are included in the fiscal year 08-09 budget and the fiscal year 10-11 governor's recommendations. We have been directed to incorporate a 10% budget reduction on the general fund, and you'll see that in your documents, I'm sure you have in your folder. And that's reflected principally in that first line there of general fund. The second line shows the clean water legacy funding that was general fund appropriations from the past biennium. The third line indicates the governor's recommendations for the Clean Water Fund, and I'll get into some more detail on that on the next page. For the upcoming biennium, we have to recognize that less than half of that will be available likely in fiscal year 10 because of the fund having to be filled, and then, of course, it comes in, you know, month by month. We also have the Southeast Flood Response. We had a $3 million appropriation, of which some carries over, and there's also an additional $275,000 that was put into the base for this 1 year of fiscal year 10 to continue the engineering and technical services to get those projects accomplished. There are some funds in Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, the LCCMR pass-through. The federal funding we have, that's really the funding that we get from the Department of Defense to acquire those easements in the area around Camp Ripley, the ACUB, it's known as Army Compatible Use Buffer, is what that ACUB stands for. And then we have a category of special revenue, which is fees, transfers. A couple of those are, there's a chunk in there of the Southeast Flood money that was transferred to Bowser from Deed to do more of those conservation projects. We have banking fees that are charged on those transactions, and we have some of the money coming in through an agreement with MnDOT to restore wetlands on their behalf. So that's a comparison of past and future biennium. And then at the bottom of the page, you know, the details of how the general fund 10% reduction will be made are not yet with any detail. I will say, though, that, you know, the proportions here are about what you would expect to put the, into those two categories of agency operations and the grants of governments, and if you look at 10% across both of those, that's probably the same proportion we'll be looking at in the current or the future biennium. And just want to point out that a lot of these, you know, the thing we want to preserve and protect is the ability to leverage that federal money, which is really important. We've been able to do that through the USDA principally, but also through other federal sources. And generally, we look at about a 1 to 1.4 ratio for every dollar we're able to put forward on a conservation easement or a conservation cost share program. We get about $1.4 in project dollars back from those federal organizations. And on the back page, these are a little bit more detail of our best estimates as to what we might expect the Clean Water Fund to be targeted at, the portion that would come through Bowser. Again, you know, much of this would go through to local governments for projects that they've identified as priority in their plans. And you can see that first category of non-point implementation, this is that very category of projects to achieve pollutant reduction in those impaired waters and other places. The next category is conservation and preservation grants, which is really where we have high-quality resources, protecting them so we don't get into a state of degradation. Local assistance and accountability, we talked about the need to make sure we have oversight of these dollars and clear tracking of both different funds as well as conservation results on the ground. We have the need to upgrade a number of our feedlots, and those feedlot water quality projects are tied to regulations that are currently in place through the Pollution Control Agency. We also have a small component that would deal with drainage management going forward, because those systems are important contributors to our water quality and quantity issues. So with that, I will take any questions or comments.
Thank you, Mr. Jaski. Senator Dill.
Madam Chair, Mr. Jaski, I would like to thank you for doing a good job of communicating with us. I've been in too many meetings lately where they've had these handouts, and they started going through them, and there was no page numbers. And they keep saying, well, and the next page is this and so on. I wonder what the next page is. But you routinely referred to what page you were on, so I didn't get lost. Thank you.
Those basics make a big difference, don't they? So, okay, let's look at the recommended budget from the governor's office, 1.7 roughly per year. So what is the give us some breakdown of what that will look like. I mean, do you know where that?
Madam Chair, we don't have all the details yet, but I would, again, look at a ratio that's probably similar to what you see in that little triangle there in the bottom of page 29 of, you know, if you took the 10%, which is $1.75 million, if you took a quarter of that, let's say, for agency operations, that would be about $450,000, and it'd be about $1.3 million across the various grant programs the agency administers to local governments if we were to use that same proportion.
So what's – okay, you said $450,000 from agency operations. Yep. How many staff – that would basically mean staff reductions or what? How else could you reduce operations?
Madam Chair, members, that is the primary mechanism to accomplish that, yes. We've got some vacancies that we would need to eliminate positions altogether. We've got a soil specialist that's vacant. We would probably put that at halftime. We've got a section manager position that's open, we'd probably eliminate that position. We've got a contract in place that, or a planned contract, to upgrade our E-Link system to allow public access to this system. We'd probably have to defer that, or maybe just leave it without that functionality for the moment. We've got a measures and outcomes position that would be remaining unfilled. And we've got two positions aligned with drainage management and the training coordinator position that we would have to make some decisions about how many, if any, of those would be able to be filled.
So does that add up to $450,000 roughly, or do you think there'll be more? Will there be layoffs to meet
Madam
that
Chair,
percentage?
I don't know if there would be, but those positions I just named would add up to about that number, yes.
Okay.
Including that contract that we wouldn't move forward on to upgrade the E-Link system.
And we, I mean, in a minute, we should talk about the governor's rec for a large amount of additional funding from the legacy funds, from the constitutional funds. And, you know, that ties into the question of your capacity to use $34 million more in the next biennium when you're reducing staff positions. How, you know, doesn't that call into question your ability to really, would you just be refilling those positions next year?
Madam Chair and members, we wouldn't just fill those positions because they would be different positions. Now, would the same people be able to do different activities? I don't know. I don't have that kind of detail yet, Madam Chair.
So I don't know. I mean, you mentioned a soil scientist.
We have a.
How many do you have already?
Yeah, we have a state soil specialist who was paid for originally half by the university and half by us. Okay. In the most recent couple of biennium, we've paid for that entire position. And so what we would like to do is have the university find some money to continue that half. Whether they can or not is a question mark, I'm sure, for them as well as us. So those are some things that we're going to just leave unfilled for the short term and then see what kinds of needs are present when we get closer to the beginning of the calendar year, let's put it that way.
Well, clearly, if you're going to have, you know, tens of millions of more dollars in your budget next biennium, you're going to be a lot more able to fill those positions than the University of Minnesota is going to be able to. So,
correct.
I mean, I think it's going to be extremely difficult to move forward without supplanting those existing funding sources. Why don't you go next down to the grants? You said that's where the biggest percentage of cuts would come from. There's a lot of different grant programs. How are you looking at selecting those? Or an across-the-board cut?
Yeah. Madam Chair, we'll have to see how much detail is in the bill, but I would say that our intent would be to preserve, to the extent possible, those grant programs that protect the existing resources that we have, with the idea that some of the project dollars may be able to come from either federal sources or other new sources of revenue. So keep the technical capacity as you were describing, keep the oversight and local government protection measures in place so that we don't, you know, we reduce our grants that protect wetlands, protect our shorelands, protect, you know, our water quality from septics and things like that. Keep those as whole as possible. And if we have to make cuts, do it more in the projects area because they will be able to look for other revenue sources for that.
Yeah, we've put ourselves into a bit of a bind here with our constitutional language because then if you eliminate some projects, you won't be able to fund them with the new money or you'll run afoul of the Constitution and the voters' intent. So it makes things a little difficult. Okay, what's the third category? Oh, the federal funds.
Sorry, yeah, Madam Chair, that's not a category for reductions.
Yeah.
It's just a
right.
point to make about the fact that we don't want to cut are things that compromise our ability to leverage as federal funds. And so that's my point about the federal funds typically will provide project costs, but they will not provide technical assistance or implementation costs. So we get money from the federal government to do projects, but they don't provide technical assistance or, you know, staff time to do that or contract dollars. So we would try and preserve those funds because they can pick up some of those project dollars.
Are you looking to the federal stimulus package? Is there anything, are there any of those grants that are being proposed that could be aimed at your agency?
Madam Chair and members, we did have a recent conversation last Friday with the USDA, Natural Resource Conservation Service, and they are expecting, they're hoping for, who knows when it's going to happen, but emergency watershed protection dollars, which would come through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they would be project dollars for things that are ready to go on the ground right now. So we gave them a list of projects that are ready that we could partner with them on. And so that's the one specific example I have for. And they requested $5 million to basically match some of the state.
The Department of Ag did?
The Natural Resources Conservation Service, the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Asked for $5 million?
$5 million under the Emergency Watershed Protection Program.
For the whole country?
The whole state.
Okay. Sorry. That'll go a little further.
Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry.
As we get like our 50 cents, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they requested $5 million for Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And what exactly are those grants used for?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, those are for projects that are basically either stream restorations, wetland restorations. In some cases, they might even be for flood damage projects. I should also point out yesterday, I forgot about this. The Army Corps of Engineers met with a colonel over there, and they said that they're expecting to get some more funding for flood damage projects that are, you know, ready to go. And they've submitted a list of those projects as well. So where those dollars come from and where they get to is yet to be determined, but that's another category of project dollars that will be available if that federal stimulus comes through based on best estimates to date.
And do those require a state match?
Madam Chair, they may or may not, but they do require the state or local ability to get the projects built.
Mm-hmm. And do you think you have that capacity ready to go?
Madam Chair, members, I believe we do. We may need to supplement with some contracts, which is what we do already for, you know, spikes in workload or special services we need through, you know, private engineering firms.
And you have, what funding do you use for those special contracts?
Madam Chair, it's the same sources that you're the state funding now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's either the local governments, if they contract for some of those services, they use a portion of the grant. If we contract for those services, it comes out of the agency operations component.
Okay. We passed out a list of previous grants, and do you want to go
sure.
through this, Dan? So we'll have Mr. Mueller just go through this information that he received from you.
Madam Chair and members, I asked Mr. Jaschke, and he actually did a really good job of putting together some of the I asked basically what was the unobligated balance of some of the previous year's appropriations, just to see how they're doing and they're getting the money out the door. And also this will, and Mr. Jaschke can talk about any of the large numbers that we see on that first gray column is basically the unobligated balance. Those are the dollars that are they still haven't either contracted for to go out the door yet or are still working on. And this will also go into the Board of Water and Soil Resources did get three different unallotments. There's two on the first page of this handout, and there's one on the other side in their admin.
And those are the ones with the little number one and
yes.
two next to them?
Okay. And the governor's office did use sort of the two columns at the end, the unobligated balance and unspent balance, to try to find areas where they could unallot. So I asked the board to put this together basically to look at, like I said, how they're getting the money out the door from their previous biennium, and then also to show where the unallotments came from. So maybe Mr. Jaschke will want to point out some of the now, some of these appropriations or these line items do have language which allows them to keep the money until spent, so it wouldn't cancel at the end of the biennium. But a few of these areas, mostly in the ones that start with CWL, the Clean Water Legacy, if they don't get the money obligated by the end of this biennium, they will cancel. So so this is just out there to...
So the unobligated balance for these unallotted items, is that the amount before it was unallotted or after?
Madam Chair, that's the amount
Mr. Jackson.
After the unallotment.
Okay, so there's still a balance
yes.
in both of these programs, not very big in the feedlot case of the feedlot program. Where do we show the unallotment amount?
Madam Chair, at the very bottom is a footnote that describes the amount. The total was $300,000.
Okay.
You have two on the front page and then one on the...
So just sort of, you know, this is a lot of
yeah.
information here, but maybe you could just tell us what you think on this list of these, you know, the unobligated balances. Are these likely to get... I mean, what is this big deed one? The Southeast Minnesota transferred... Was that money transferred to you from deed or the other way around? I forget.
Madam Chair, it was transferred from deed to us, and that one along with that other... There's a couple other ones in there that are Southeast flood related. Those are funds that were, you know, allowed to be carried forward because you can't do these projects in the middle of winter. So these are funds that we have available through the remainder of the biennium or the new biennium. But we expect to have those expended this summer or this spring when they get those projects identified and prioritized. And they will write contracts or grant agreements to get those projects on the ground. So those are the larger numbers. That the first line there is part of that as well, $441,000.
So just going through these, do you think you'll be able to, do you have enough staff and projects ready to go to use up most of these grants by the end of the fiscal year or maybe the end of the calendar year?
Madam Chair, for those flood response lines, those will be obligated for sure by the end of the calendar year. As Mr. Mueller indicated, the Clean Water Legacy ones will be, they will be utilized for projects that are already identified. They just haven't been grant agreements signed with those. Those are continuation projects, and so that's why we held some of that Clean Water Legacy funding, because some of the projects were more than a two-year project, as you can imagine, and we're going to be dealing with that going forward as well. And so these are basically the continuation funds for those projects that we held them until the first phase of the project was done and they successfully completed that, and we would allocate these funds in that second phase. That's that $771,000 line.
And then that one, there was $200,000 unallotted. So what will that do?
Madam Chair, what we estimated was that there would be three projects that would not be continued based on that reduction. And the other ones I can point out, the feedlot one would probably be about two feedlot projects wouldn't go forward. And then the other one on the unallotment regarding the WACA rulemaking, we're at this point crossing our fingers that we don't have a long, lengthy hearing process, because we've been working on that informally for about a year before we get to the official hearing process, so we don't have to pay the administrative law judge as much as we might have otherwise had to if we had a controversial rulemaking process.
So maybe you can just describe with the clean water money, you said there's three projects that will be discontinued. Describe what those are. How would you select them?
Madam Chair, I can't tell you exactly which three because I just don't have that information with me. I can get that to you, though. We've got dozens of these projects, if not more than that, and I don't have that information with me. I'm sorry. I'll get it to you in a follow-up communication.
Okay. And then are there other questions from the committee about this? All right. I'm just looking at the other large numbers. I guess on the next page, there's – what about the wetlands oversight? How do you isn't that mostly people out in the field? That's basically personnel.
Yes, Madam Chair. That's our staff that are doing that oversight. The reason that number has got a larger component to it is because we hired some new staff, and they did not come on board until partway through the biennium, and so we have salary savings basically going back to the first part of that biennium. I think there was probably two of the four that we hired that were not hired until maybe almost a year into the biennium.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then do you have other questions about this? Okay. Do you want to talk about the governor's rec for new funding?
Sure, Madam Chair and members, that's on page 30 for Senator Bill and others at the top. This is our, what we had submitted for the breakdown of this Clean Water Fund. And the biggest category is the same category that was, carved. There's basically several main categories. There's assessment and monitoring, which is collecting the data and then developing the TMDL plans. That's basically going to be part of the PCA's component. And this, I should remind you that the Clean Water Council that was established to put forward recommendations, they did so, and I think they sent a communication to this committee and others saying, here's our recommendations. I haven't been able to compare the Clean Water Council's recommendations with the governor's recommendations, but I'm guessing that they're not so far off, at least in those big categories. I think the one difference will be that the governor's recommendations in fiscal year 10 are a lower number, at least they were for our agency, than what the Clean Water Council had recommended, but that's recognizing the time it takes to fill that fund. But the vast majority here is, for Bowser, is about getting those projects on the ground to do clean water, whether it's hard infrastructure or soft infrastructure. It's those same kinds of projects that are identified in those TMDL plans that need to be done in these locations these priority areas, and those are incorporated into these local plans, and they will go forward with efforts to get those accomplished. Riparian buffers are one example, grassed waterways, rain gardens. There may be some more elaborate water chemistry projects that are undertaken. There could be stormwater projects where you're getting both water quality as well as water quantity management in those. We've done this through an RFP process in previous years, and I expect we would do something quite similar with most of the funding again to get the best of the ideas and the best of the project proposals into our agency for our board's consideration.
So is your plan, you just fund the TMDL? Once a TMDL is done, is that when you're getting involved with all this money, or do you have other responsibilities that you'll use this $34 million for?
Madam Chair and members, it's a good question. It's for that, the primary connection, I would say, is that those TMDL plans say, here's what needs to be done and where and what kind of reductions we need to achieve. But we also, as I mentioned earlier, want to make sure that we provide protection so that we don't have existing waters that aren't impaired or haven't been analyzed yet. We don't have degradation occurring on those as well. So it's a combination. The ratio of that is maybe 75-25, if I had to make a rough estimate of, you know, the non-point. You'd have three-fourths of it going to places where we have to do restoration because of impairments, and maybe the other 25% to preserve threatened resources that may otherwise get impaired someday if we don't protect them now.
Okay, so the 75% or so that's going to the impaired waters, once you'll get these steps will take effect once the TMDL is in place, or some of them are already in place?
Madam Chair, some of them are already in place. Many of them then, once they're established, they get incorporated into these local water plans, and they get the specifics about which projects, where, and how to most cost-effectively accomplish them. But there are places in Minnesota, many places, where we either haven't yet gotten to do the assessment or write a plan, even though we may think there's a problem on the land and need restoration, or we've got threats to high-quality waters that we want to stave off so that we don't get into a circumstance where we have to restore them. So a portion of the funding will go to that. At this point, there isn't that definitiveness in place to tell you exactly how much will go to which category. What we tried to do here in this pie chart is just to talk about some of the kinds of activities that would be funded. And, of course, that biggest component of that is the one you're asking about, which, unfortunately, Madam Chair, I have the least definition for at this point in time.
Well, and the next question I have about that is, how do you know when you're done? I mean, what's the end point of each implementation with each watershed? I mean, how do you achieve your goals? And how do you assess that?
Madam Chair, there's a couple of different ways. Obviously, the one that people think of the first is measuring the water quality in the particular water body or water course. But we have to be much more specific than that, because we got to know whether these practices are working way sooner than, you know, years down the road when the water quality hopefully is going to be back to some standard. We've got field-level monitoring that we've established, not everywhere, but on a sample basis. I mentioned that research project out in west central Minnesota looking at the effective riparian buffers. The thing that they determined there was the first 50 feet is the most critical. You get some, you know, additional benefits, but they deplete in terms of the amount of land you have to use for that same benefit. So we have a number of those measures in place. But they range from, you know, large-scale watershed measurements to field-level measurements.
So, I mean, we're going to need more information. Obviously, you said you're still working on putting together the details of this. But, you know, we're going to want to know how you're going to achieve long-term goals with this large amount of new money coming in for a long time to come. You know, what progress can we expect in what timeline? So, you know, and I think under the Clean Water Legacy Act, we have this 10-year standard for testing and assessing, and I think that includes fixing. I'm not sure if that it says specifically you're supposed to achieve your water quality goals within 10 years, but you're supposed to go through the whole cycle in 10 years and have some, you know, something to show for it.
Madam Chair, I would just respond. I think the 10-year assessment was for getting the monitoring and the data and the TMDL plans written, and that, you know, we've got 25 years based on what the Constitution has said for us to use these resources to achieve those water quality improvements. But that'll be on a, you know, a case-by-case, watershed-by-watershed, water-body-by-water-body basis. But we will be coming back to you, hopefully, with more details about those measures, how we're going to pursue the results you're looking for, and how we're able to show the results that need to happen based on those assessments and those plans. And, you know, one of the tools that we have in place, which we'll be utilizing in ever more, hopefully, detailed ways, is that E-Link program that I talked about, you know, on page here on page 26. And we have this system in place for all these projects, and someday we can walk you through more details. But every project, we can identify the multiple sources of funding that may have been committed to that project, because, again, Minnesota hopefully isn't going to be able to exercise a lot of leveraging of federal resources to help our clean water efforts going forward. And this also then can tell us the benefits of each of those projects. Now, that's not all of it, but that's a very good start, in my opinion.
Okay. And we'd like to know, you know, we're also going to need kind of the budget breakdown in terms of where the money goes and, you know, how much of it will be staffing and how much of it will be restoration work, how much is grants, et cetera, to, you know, just so we can have some comfort about how this public money is being used. I should mention to members in the public that we just appointed subcommittees, and Senator Rummel, unfortunately she's not here right now, but she'll be chairing the subcommittee that will be looking at taking the first pass at the use of the legacy funds for water. And Senator Torres Ray will be chairing the subcommittee that will do the same for the Parks and Trails, the new dedicated funds for Parks and Trails. So on Thursday at our committee time, Senator Rummel's subcommittee will meet for the first time and hear from the Clean Water Council and hear their proposals. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to go back to the comment that you just made and perhaps reinforce that with a request. As a new member, I think I have a difficult time trying to put together the budget with your mission and try to figure out whether or not we're accomplishing what we need to accomplish with, I guess, is if we put this money together, is about $48 million. And one thing that I hear constantly in my district and outside of my district, for instance, is that about 70% of non-point source pollution in water comes from agricultural land. And that we have known that forever and ever in Minnesota, but we have never really designed a plan to deal with it. And so that if we really are to look at the future on how we use this funding that we are going to get, we could very well go in a direction where we continue to use this funding to get water remediation projects in place and never deal with the prevention part of this. And so what I would like to say, Madam Chair, is that I would like to see a presentation where we see, kind of in terms of time, how much progress we have made in terms of solving those key issues that are that need to be resolved. And so what is our vision to do that? Because if we don't do that, we're going to need 10 times this number, and we're never going to make progress. And so I don't know if it is true that we've known, you know, for 10 years that, you know, 70% of the pollution comes from this source, and we've done nothing about it to improve that. And I would like to know what is the agency's plan to actually change that so that we can put more funding into that idea.
Mr. Jasky?
Senator, you know, your number, I don't know where it came from, but we can find out if that's the right number or not and where it's sourced from. But certainly many things that are being done. You know, the question is, you know, how can we make the most use of what we have going forward? I appreciate your sentiments in that. Lots of our landscape is in agricultural production. That's an important part of Minnesota's economy and culture, and we got to, you know, we got to make sure those are, things are done well too. But your idea of having a presentation about some of the maybe the most relevant and recent research or findings to kind of summarize for your benefit and others would be a good idea, and we'd be happy to participate in helping you pull that off if you want to do that.
Well, Senator Torres, right, we had a presentation in Senator Chaudhry's committee that touched on, I think it was probably the Freshwater Society study on water that was very interesting. We may want to bring that here, too, for those members who aren't on the policy committee. Mm-hmm. And they talked about the sources of water runoff and or, you know, impairments and that are based from non-point sources. And I think you raise a really good point that what we need to see in order to really, you know, to keep the faith with the public on this money is we need to establish what our goals are. And with all the grants that we've, all the work that Bowser has done in recent years, can we measure any improvements in water quality in the areas where you've done work on buffers or, you know, other or restorations along riparian pieces of land? And I'm not sure if there's some comparable work you've done in more metropolitan areas that would have that kind of, that have created reductions in runoff too. I don't know. But we need to see, we need to set those goals across the state for the different sources of non-point pollution. And it's, you know, it's urban sources and rural sources. It's, they're both contributing, and they both have solutions that can be accomplished, I think, without jeopardizing our agricultural economy or our economy in general. I mean, these 50-foot buffers that you're talking about, I mean, we should just have them along every waterway in Minnesota. That's what I think, and I know that's easier said than done, and, of course, if it's someone's private land, it's not a simple thing.
And we tried to use that Green Acres and didn't get no place.
Yeah. Well, we've tried a lot of things, but now we have some money to work with, so we got to make sure that we're getting as close to that goal as we can. I mean, if you have land that's got vegetation on it along ditches, rivers, and lakes, then you're going to make a huge impact on this across, and if you try to keep the water on the landscape. But we need to set some goals. I mean, I think we're really going to be focused on having outcomes that we can measure to get the job done, maybe more than we have in the past. Mr. Jaskin.
Madam Chair and Senator, I want to introduce Julie Clocker. She's our assistant director, and actually one of her assignments is to do what you were just describing, Senator and Madam Chair. So we'll be working with you on that. And today I was just trying to cover everything in a fairly short period of time and get to those numbers at the end so you could have a chance to see what those are with more details yet to come. But we look forward to working with you on getting much more specific about those important outcomes.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And, you know, this ties to something. 78%, you have this in your report, 78% of this land is in private hands. And so many argue that if we really don't have a system in place to provide the incentives and to educate the community about the value of implementing these programs and participating, it's just not going to happen. And we cannot regulate that in terms of sanctions only, because this is private land. And so I do look forward to hear your presentation on that, because it's a tremendous challenge, I think, for the state of Minnesota, where we have so much of our land in private hands. And so we need to know what are the most effective measures that we can put in place to get to where we need to go. Thank you.
Can I say something?
Well, I think I do,
Senator Fredrickson.
I was just going to observe that the effectiveness of the programs and the amount of sediment or other pollution coming off the land is going to vary from one watershed to another. You might have a watershed where the farmers, the landowners, have been very active with the soil and water conservation districts. They have a very high number of cooperators and have done a very good job of reducing the sediment and other pollutants coming off the land. Mm-hmm. You might have another watershed where there's been a lot of resistance mm-hmm. to these type of programs where you don't have that kind of improvement. So I think we need to be selective as we talk about each individual watershed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And the TMDLs hopefully will help us to do that. Other comments? Senator Shad, we were just talking about, didn't the Fresh Water Society report that you had in your committee? It may be useful to bring them here, too, because people have a lot of questions about
it. I was just wondering if the committee had been blackballed.
Well, we made Dr. Jolly.
Is that the symbol?
We made him demonstrate twice that one of these bounces and one doesn't. So we're just going to tell you, throw them both up in the air. Not right now. We've already done that. And then see what happens, and then put them in the freezer and do it again, okay?
All right. Good.
And then report back to the committee, all right? Yeah, that'll be your homework assignment.
Except that when you do that, you have to mark the one that bounced first.
That's right. Put like a
or didn't bounce. You have to mark one of them.
Something on it.
So when you get them out, you can figure out what happened.
Definitely. You can tell you've done your science projects before. Yeah. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is on page 27. When you were talking about the soil productivity and sustainability for food and energy, what can we do? What should we be thinking about this competition for how we use our soil? Have you given some thought to that? Or soil and water, I guess.
Madam Chair and members, certain things that we grow in our soil can grow in many places, and some can only grow where you've got certain soil conditions. So we typically grow our food crops, where we have the most productive soil traditionally, and we believe that there's opportunities to grow some of the energy crops where you have some of the not as productive soil, but can still, with native plants, for example, over the years, evolve that science and technology and use those landscapes for some productive purposes. And that's why I mentioned that one of the things that we were able to accomplish last session with some changes you gave us was to allow for some harvesting of those easement areas, which are in the marginal lands, for biofuel production, because you've got perennial grasses coming back and again. And frankly, doing harvest occasionally is a better use of that land than having to burn it, because burning, of course, it costs money and it, releases carbon and so forth. So we think that there are some ideas around that we can evolve as we go forward. But the soil we got is what we're going to have, right? Minnesota is not growing in terms of, geography, and we're not piling up soil every day like we do snow, so we have to make the most of that. And certainly inputs to those soil profile over the years with fertilizers and other things have improved productivity, and that's important as well. We just got to make sure we don't overuse it, I guess is the best way to say it.
Mr. Jaski, a couple things you mentioned in your proposal to, your tentative ideas for cutting the budget were you said you would not complete this e-link, which would make this information available to the public.
Let me clarify that, Madam Chair. We recently put a major effort into making it fully web-based, so it is fully web-based.
Okay.
But so all of our local governments can utilize it, and we can generate reports. Anybody that wants a report, we can generate them for them. We were having the idea that we would put out a self-user version of it so people could go on and get data and then, develop their own kind of reports, anybody that wanted to. The challenge with that is you got to create I don't want to use the word, an e-link for dummies, but you got to create a simplified version of it, right, for people who aren't familiar.
I wouldn't title it that. on the web.
Those books sold a lot of books. And then we have to put in, protection measures so the data doesn't get compromised. And so there's some additional cost to create that sort of thing. But we just completed a upgrade of it to make it fully web-based, which is a very major step forward for simplicity and efficiency. So not all is lost. We'll just have to wait and see if we can find money to make it publicly accessible to anyone who wants to use it or see it.
Well, I think, I'd like to know as we go forward what the cost of doing that is, and that seems to me an important function to make sure moves ahead for the public. And secondly, you mentioned in your positions of measurements and outcomes staffing position. What is that? That's a vacant position now?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And how long has it been vacant?
We created it about 6 months ago, and it's been vacant since then, because about the time we created it, it was...
So it's never been filled.
It's never been filled, but it goes to what you were just describing, and Senator Torres Ray, too, about, these measurable outcomes. We've got the thing all set up. We just got to make sure we have the resources to fill it. We support your idea.
So that's not been funded by traditional funding. So
it's never been funded, Madam Chair, but we've created the position. One more thing, I just want to those of you who, you know, don't get a chance to go all over the state, if inside of here there's a more detailed list of some of the things we heard and some of the themes. So you can take this with you. You don't need to look at it now necessarily, but Minnesota's a very diverse state, and you hear different things from one part of the state to the other. As Senator Frederickson was saying, you know, every place is a little bit different, and you may get some insights to, you know, how you're going to need to go forward with defining what the priorities are for this new funding. And, you know, if you have any questions about that, feel free to let me know, and we'll try and expand on any of those.
You know, Mr. Jasky, that raises another point. This was a good presentation at the Heritage Council that you made. Another question that I'm hearing a lot is about, with the new constitutional funds, is the geographic breakdown of how they'll be spent. And so when you come back with more detail about that, I'd like to know what that looks like, too, at least hypothetically.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I should tell you, too, that our board members are very cognizant of that spread, because they're geographically represented around the state as well. Mm-hmm. We will make sure we do that.
Great. Are there any other questions? Okay, well, we'll be seeing you again soon, no doubt.
Okay, thank you, Madam
Great.
Chair.
Thanks so much for being here today. We appreciate it. And members, Thursday we'll have the subcommittees meeting, and you should have received your subcommittee assignments.
When are you going to announce it?
We announced it yesterday. We sent you email. Do you know all the members offhand, off the top of your head? Or
our first one?
No, probably not. I don't mean to put you on the spot, but we can. Your staff should have that. We tried to follow whatever everybody's request was. We did follow. Yeah, we basically, whatever you requested, we put you on. So your staff should have that information and put it on your schedule, hopefully. All right, thank you all. The committee's adjourned.